Good afternoon, everybody, or good evening, or good morning, depending on where you are. I'm Hunt Tooley, and this is the fourth installment of the Totalitarians course with the Ludwig von Mises Institute and the Mises Academy. So we will begin now, and it's good to have you with us again. And these are indeed some dark topics that we're discussing, but I think that's you know, in the Misesian spirit of do not give way to evil, that we're attempting here in some way to claw our way toward the light. So so I'm glad you're with me, and for those who are not listening in real time and are listening a little later, hello to you too. And I hope that sometime, even those who are on a regular basis listening in later time, I know the time zones are, in many cases, difficult. But it is fun to have a lot of good discussion at the end. We give over a long period at the end to discussion, and I try to answer questions or raise questions or field comments, and a lot of good comments are made, and a lot of people add a lot of things. So maybe you can jump on sometime, get up at 3 a.m. or whatever, and try to do that. So, but let's begin. This is installment number 4. It's the Totalitarians. We already said that. And here we are, the Totalitarian 8-week plan, and we're just knocking them off. I mean, in the same way that the totalitarians did, we just give ourselves a quota, and whether we get it or not, that quota is accomplished, and we just mark it off. I'm just making it green, no matter what we did last week. But this week we talk about World War I, but we need to pick up a whole handful of different kinds of things this week. So it won't be just about the World War. I do want to mention that that the way I'm looking for this to go is for us to get some familiarity with the topic, think about the book Omnipotent Government, that is the kind of centerpiece of the book, and then we keep coming back to these as we start toward the new topic. So this week we're going to talk a little bit more about the origins of the early life of Lenin that we talked about last time, talk a little bit more about Russian socialism. We're going to talk a little bit more about German pan-Germanism and Russian pan-Slavism than we did last week. So I tried to just get the concept out there last week. We go into it a little bit more deeply. And as we move through, by the time we get to next week and the week after, we're really going to be in the comparing mode, and we're going to be in a little more discursive mode, I think, and a little less narrative, although there's plenty of narratives there that make all this up. So that's what I would like to have you sort of thinking of. In other words, when we hit a topic, it's not the last time that you'll see it, no doubt. And, of course, you can always bring up issues in the question and answer, and that's helpful for me to know what you're thinking and know what you'd like to hear more about and what you'd like to kind of see explored. So there are two fellow travelers of the totalitarians, and what I'd like to do is to take one of the couple of the last slides from the last presentation. We ended up sort of talking about Russian history, a little Russian history lesson. And I'm not going to dwell on these, but I want to get a running start at what we do at the beginning of today. So, changed unnecessarily. So, remember, there's this great reformer Tsar, the Tsar reformer, they call him, Alexander II, who he created a lot of reforms, introduced a constitution into Russia for the first time. Russia proper, I should say. So many of the components of Russia had long since had a constitution. Once they became engulfed by the Russian Empire, they no longer had, in effect, those constitutions, or many of them did not. So he carried out these reforms, was thinking of granting some kind of constitutional charter from the king, which is better than nothing, and then he was assassinated because there had been, in the midst of these reforms, this crazy disjunctive kind of atmosphere where intellectuals from say Petersburg and Moscow were going out to the fields and talking to people. You know, there's one such character in Fiddler on the Roof, if you know that musical. And there's a character who's come to the countryside to talk to the peasants, and then of course he ends up falling in love with one of the daughters of Tevye in that story or in that musical. But that's the thing. There's all this that's supposed to represent all this ferment of the 60s and 70s and going to the land, and then this further stage of a sort of violent upheaval where we say, well, we've changed as much as Alexander II will change. We have not gone far enough. Therefore, we need to start a more violent anarchistic program. And the movement Land and Freedom was the first stage of that. The people's will was an even more violent stage. And finally, the result of this tradition, this what's in Russian history called this populist tradition, ends up as a party that's founded in the 90s called the Social Revolutionary Party. It's a non-Marxist socialist party that comes into existence then. And it's not long before a Marxist party also comes into existence. But these two parties, the Social Revolutionary Party and then the Social Democratic Party of Russia, those parties really clash. And indeed, they are each other's worst enemies. At least until the Marxist Party split in 1903, and then there were three socialist parties, the non-Marxist Social Revolutionaries, or SRs, then the Marxist Socialist Party, and that was divided into the Bolshevik faction and the Menshevik faction. Bolsheviks, the smaller faction, led by Lenin, but called the majority party, the Bolshevik party. And so that's how those parties came to be. So that's part of the political background here. Again, none of these parties had a parliament to debate in or party organizations out in the open. They were all more or less subterranean, just sort of social groups. And many of these folks were sent to Siberia under the management of the Tsar's secret police, the Okhrana. And so same thing goes with the reign of the end of Alexander II, Alexander III, and then, of course, Nicholas II, who became Tsar in 1894. So all this is a part and parcel of Russian history. The Tsar was called the autocrat. That was one of the titles, autocrat of all the Russias. And the Tsars didn't want to give up power at all. So as Lenin came, born in Simbirsk in eastern Russia, as he was born into this milieu, then and his brother was hanged in a plot against Alexander III. He was a member of the Socialist Party. And Lenin grew up around this. He was from a middle-class household and became the real genius of revolution. He was the revolutionary theorist. And I should also say, and this I think is backed up by all the recent research of the last 10 or 15 years, that Lenin was the absolutely the most savage, the most relentless of all the socialists of the period. I mean, so Marxism-Leninism, which is really about Marxist theory plus Lenin's ideas about how to gain power, they have this ruthless quality where Marx thought that the individual didn't matter in history. Lenin thought the individual didn't matter in real life either, not just a broad sweep of history. Lenin thought in terms of mass killings and liquidations and so forth from even before the time of the revolution. And all of his revolutionary associates knew this. This was not a big secret. So, and as we get next week into some more developmental parts of the Stalinist regime, especially, I'll give you some titles that go into especially Lenin's history. So he uses the Marxist concept of the revolutionary vanguard, says it's his Bolshevik party. There's a big conspiratorial bent to his party. He wants committed revolutionaries. Most of them are living abroad. They all rush back to Russia in the revolution of 1905, and I'm not there yet, and try to carry out some kind of revolt, but they're not even on the map. There is a pretty big far-left movement that's more related to the SRs, and it's more related to the populist tendency in Russian history, and that is the Council movement, or Soviet movement. In 1905. And the Soviet idea is, it's a little bit more peaceful version of the old anarchist idea. That is, you have councils all around, a council in every village, and a council in every precinct, and a council in every factory, and a council in every regiment. And these councils are people who by free will get together and discuss issues, and then they decide what should happen politically, and then they send representatives to regional Soviets or councils, and then all those regional ones make decisions, and then that moves on up to the top. That is the Soviet or Soviet structure, all right? No part of the Bolshevik Party at all. Face it, the Bolshevik Party was totally Marxist, which is totally centralizing. Lenin's vanguard party run by a few Marxocratic, technocratic centralizers. That had nothing to do with little regional meetings out on the periphery. He didn't want the will for the revolution to come from below. He wanted to lead the vanguard from above. So that's the Bolsheviks had nothing to do. This is only the Soviet idea. Is only something latched onto by Lenin in the throes of the revolution just before October 1917. So that's a really important point that we need to make there. Here's another background part of Russian history, and it's really critical for us to discuss this here. And I hope our I'll view all attendees now, and is it Charles who is, Charles, I'm glad you're here, Charles. Anna Arendt is coming. I just wanted to let you know that. So one of the really important issues, and it's a kind of minor motor of some elements of modern history, is the Russian policy regarding Jews in the 18th, 19th, and early 20th centuries, all right? What happened under Catherine the Great, who was a ruthless, power-hungry monarch, aggressive monarch, and so we call her Catherine the Great, right? Well, Catherine the Great introduced into Russia the reform of Jewish life, in that she said Jews should not be present in Russia, that they destroyed the economic system, that their banking activities, their farming activities, their anti-Russian, whatever. And so she, for a whole series of reasons, established in the Western conquest of her country. She picked up a huge chunk of Ukraine, Poland, Lithuania, some other places late in her reign, it means of a series of wars. And Poland was extinct at that point after three separate wars. And in these regions, she designated this as the Pale of Settlement for Jews, so that Russian Jews were forced, beginning in Catherine the Great's reign, to the western part of the country. It was not all at once. And certain groups of Jews in certain places had different sort of negotiated statuses and so forth. This took a long time. In fact, Alexander I backed off of this policy a little bit, and then it was restarted under Nicholas I, and then Alexander II backed off, and then at the end of Alexander II, in the beginning of Alexander III, things really, really took off. That is to say, they took off because the nationalism and the Pan-Slavism that Mises discusses in Omnipotent Government really takes hold of the leading political classes of Russia. So the Pan-Slavism is an exact equivalent, and it has many of the same bases as Pan-Germanism. It has that Darwinian, that sort of hard biological edge of biological ethnocentrism and all that. And so the Pan-Slavic activists surrounding Alexander III, and to some extent even Alexander II before him, began to put real pressure on Jews to leave. And they decreed or allowed to happen pogroms, that is to say, raids on villages where people were beaten up and murdered and their houses burned and so forth, where they were driven out on the countryside, all kinds of brutalities. And eventually these became kind of organized by a whole set of, you might say, paramilitary groups called Black Hundreds. So there was tremendous pressure. And if I say here again, I'm able to bring up Fiddler on the Roof twice. Isn't that lucky? You didn't think you'd hear that twice or once in this lecture. But think Fiddler on the Roof. I mean, this is based on a short story from an individual who experienced this, the play is, I mean. And it's exactly like that. There was so much pressure, but it was uneven pressure from St. Petersburg, the capital. It was also partly just local, and part of it had to do with the government turning a blind eye on these activities so that neighbors could go and loot and harass their neighbors. So that's the way it went. By the way, the structure, the living structure in this Pale of Civilization can be explored quite easily at a website I should have put on here, but I didn't. The map is from the Jewish Virtual Library, and it's a pretty good map, and I have tried to link it. I hope that link does work so that you can hit the map or hit that link there and go to a bigger version of it. But there's also a very extensive, wonderful website about the Pale of Settlement and the social life there and the political aspects of it, with a lot of photographs on the web. I just forgot to put the link here, but Google Pale of Settlement, and I think you'll find it easily. So if you want to know more about that, that is available. In these regions, and you see this region outlined, I have a pointer, don't I? Is this the pointer? I think it is, yeah. So if you look in this region here that's outlined, this whole thing is the Pale of Settlement, and within that the settlement had occurred so that in many cases there were Jewish centers to say Polish or Ukrainian towns. In many cases there was a Jewish farming village just isolated by itself. In many cases there were villages side by side, as is, I believe, the case in Anatevka, the fictional town in Fiddler on the Roof. That is to say, a Jewish farming village here and another one by its side. So all of these things were possible, and the Jews were, on the whole, economically better off than their neighbors. And so this follows the pattern that Mises discusses in Omnipotent Government. Well, beginning in the 1880s, Pan-Slavicists were able to create a series of laws, not only the pogroms, but laws actually that pressured Jews to leave. And so beginning at this time, there was an outflow of Jews to, all over the place. They came to the Americas, all over the place, especially to North America. They some actually participated in the very beginning waves of Jews going to Israel as a part of the Zionist movement. And of course, many of these Jews, and I'll grab my pointer again here, and say if you're a Jewish family leaving from this region, and you don't have the means to go to New York or Chicago, then what you might well do is to make your way to Breslau, or even further on, and I'm off the map there, I see that, but even further on to Berlin, which is right there. Or if you're a Ukrainian Jew and you want to take your family to some place where you can set up anew, and remember, if you're an agricultural family, it's going to be very hard to sort of lock into the agricultural system in most countries, since that's generally speaking a state-protected activity. In most countries. So these Jews are looking to go someplace and they end up in, say, Budapest or Vienna or some other German city, some of the Central European city, I should say. So there was a mass movement of Jews, so millions of Jews moving outward, and this is the period at which, of course, everybody knows that large sections of New York City became Jewish. It's the origin of so much in American culture that comes out of New York City. Everything from the bagel to the Borscht Belt comedians to all of it. It's this outflow with some other outflows, some other immigration from Jews in other areas of the world, but especially this outflow of Jews from Russia. And so, I can also point out that there's an important kind of lesson here about what people do when they immigrate, and that's what they can. As I said, it was in a sense hard to buy into the agricultural system in many countries, and Jews who immigrated to, say, New York or Boston or Chicago or Philadelphia tended to get into service type roles where they can make some money immediately. And then the second generation generally, it's a pattern in many immigrations that you can think of right now. And so I'm thinking, for example, of Kirk Douglas's father, who was in a job which they call rag picker in New York City when he moved the family there from Russia. And that was we wouldn't call that today. They called it then rag picker, but we would say it's recycling, because he just picked up old rags in the trash heaps behind people's houses and sold them. And then the second generation is Kirk Douglas, and then the third generation is Michael Douglas, and you see how that goes. So anyway, there's that process going on. We could follow it up in many, many ways. But it does mean that Jews are appearing in great numbers in Vienna, in great numbers in Linz, in great numbers in Berlin, and they're not the old aristocratic Jewish families like Bismarck's banker Bleichröder, who has millions in a fortune of millions and several estates and travels the world and is welcome in everybody's home and all those kinds of things. These are poor Jews, for the most part, from this Pale of Settlement. So this is an important element, and it plays a role in this discussion of anti-Semitism that we just kind of rushed through last week a little bit. Here is this important. This provides the background in Vienna. In Vienna, there was an anti-Semitic party that came about because there were so many Jews, and it was the atmosphere of that particular party was partly this kind of Darwinian scientific racism and all that, but it was also partly the kind of anti-foreigner movement that you see with the argument, oh, they're going to come take our jobs, take jobs away from good Germans or good Americans or whatever. So that's an important part of this history, where Russian history imposes on other histories a kind of burden, you might say. Well, having said that, then I want to talk a little bit about the anti-Semitism as it's covered in Omnipotent Government, and then I have a second slide here where I want to bring up Hannah Arendt for the first time, just by way of a comparison. So let me go back to Mises. I would say if we want to take these sections on anti-Semitism from Omnipotent Government and analyze those a little bit, let me just go down this list fairly rapidly because we have many more things to do today. But first of all, he talks about the problem of race, the issue of what we would say racism against the Jews, because the Jewish race was a race defined partly by religion and partly by physical characteristics and partly by culture, partly by place of origin. So it's a difficult thing. And as Mises points out, the Nazi Nuremberg laws, the series of laws that were the first comprehensive laws regulating and marginalizing Jews in Hitlerian Germany. Remember, Hitler came to power in January 1933. So Mises says that these Nuremberg laws are confused and uneven. They were all produced within the bowels of the SS Empire, and there were offices in there who worked a lot on this issue, but they were still confused. It's still hard to say, well, who is a Jew? If somebody's grandmother was once a Jew but converted, a religious Jew but converted to Christianity, what does that mean? What if my father was Jewish and married a Gentile mother and he converted while he was in the army so I could get a commission as a lieutenant? What does that mean? So there are all these kinds of issues once you start trying to define these sorts of things. And of course, since the state has the full power and it's saying who is going to ultimately, who will live and who will die, then these things get to be hugely important, though they're not clear at all. Mises points out that there's a whole kind of German anti-Semitic, especially Nazi anti-Semitic discussion of the Jewish mind as being some kind of different sort of mind, which Mises rejects altogether. In fact, he says, if one put together everything that various Nazis have stigmatized as Jewish, one would get the impression that our whole civilization has been the achievement only of the Jews. One thing he points out is that the Bolshevik and Nazi systems, even in this regard, are fairly close, that there is a similarity here, that the Nazi system is based in part on this sort of institutional anti-Semitism, where Jews are not allowed, even from the beginning, to be in the civil service or to be at school teachers, or and eventually they're excluded from all state institutions completely, and then eventually excluded from everything else. But the systems, he says, are the same because, or very close, because it's just they have identified different groups to dispossess, to discriminate against, and so forth. Interventionism, he says, means compulsory discrimination. This is a wonderful point that Mises makes in this section, very, very insightful. He says that decades of anti-Semitic propaganda did not prevent equal standing for Jews in society. In other words, the Jews had, from the time of the 18th century, had managed to gain a better place in European, especially Central and Western European societies. It varied from place to place. That, in fact, there was improvement all along the line, and so it wasn't the propaganda. It wasn't these few crazies, Arthur Gobineau and all these anti-Semitic writers, who in fact created the anti-Semitic atmosphere that began to arise in the 1890s. He says it took government intervention to do it, favoring, he says, the less efficient producer to the disadvantage of the consumer. But of course, as an identifiable minority, the Jews were always a tempting target for the Nazis. And that's from the very first stage. We're going to read the platform, the Nazi Party platform for next week, and we'll see that there. And then finally, there's this immediate kind of thing that we want to make the point of, that once the German commanders lost the war in the field, they felt like they had to find a scapegoat, and they found the scapegoat in the liberals and Jews and socialists of Germany. In spite of the fact that all the liberals and most of the Jews and most of the socialists were in fact super patriots who were inventing new stuff to keep the war going and to keep Germany in the war, and who were voting for war credits and all those kinds of things. So there was no stab in the back. That was a pure invention of the people who lost the war and then tried to cover their tracks, like our star of today's lecture, Ludendorff. just a brief comment to get Hannah Arendt on the agenda. Her Origins of Totalitarianism came out in 1951, and that's a few years after Mises' book. And in fact, the two have a lot of things in common. You, by the way, can find an online copy of The Origins of Totalitarianism at that link, and if it doesn't work, just paste it in, but at archive.org. And you can download it in any form. You can put it on your Kindle or whatever you want to do. Arendt is famous for having a position close to Mises. Her book is, intellectual circles at large, her book is much more famous. But many of her major points, I think, are points that Mises made with a lot more specificity and force. However, her historical account is much more extensive of the stages of totalitarianism and all that. I mean, it's a different book for a different purpose. But in terms of talking about anti-Semitism in the Origins of Totalitarianism, Arendt puts it as one of the main three things that undermine what she calls bourgeois values. In other words, middle-class Europe, liberal Europe, we might say, from the 19th century. And these, by and large, are what Mises would say too. One reviewer of the book, in a recent essay, gives a nice summary. He said, as she puts it in opening the chapter on the pan movements, Nazism and Bolshevism owe more to pan-Germanism and pan-Slavism, respectively, than to any other ideology or political movement. This is most evident in foreign politics, where the strategies of Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia have followed so closely the well-known programs of conquest outlined by the Pan movements before and during the First World War that totalitarian aims have frequently been mistaken for the pursuance of some permanent German or Russian interest. So, in a way, that's very close to the points that Mises is making. And so I think we should begin to take note of her book here. I'm not assigning it to read, but it is certainly a good part of our useful part of our discussion to know that. Okay, well, let's turn to the First World War now. And how did that come on? I don't know what that is. Can you see that? I guess everybody can see that. I don't know why it says Hunt Tooley. I'll leave it alone. I should never have worried about the cursor anyway. So, some points about the First World War. And I've got to tell you, if I get wound up on the First World War, we'll never get out of here because this is my particular interest, and it's what I've spent a lot of my lifetime thinking about and studying. And so it's a dangerous moment, but I think with these slides I can get through it. First of all, everybody knows the assassination of the Archduke was the point at which the war looks like it becomes really sort of inevitable. There's a July crisis that follows that, and a lot of tired diplomats eventually just decided to heck with it, let's go to war. The countries had, as we've already seen, sort of opposing, aggressive plans toward each other, and that really does go all around. France had an aggressive plan, Russia had an aggressive plan, the German Schlieffen plan was aggressive. Everybody had that mentality, and the war finally began in early August. Mises puts a lot of the blame on the Germans, and they deserve a lot of it. The French deserve some of it. The British deserve quite a bit. Maybe the Austrians don't deserve as much. The Russians deserve a lot. So there's enough blame to go around. We don't have to blame the Germans totally, but we can certainly talk about, the extent to which one or the other country was responsible. That's a perfectly legitimate discussion. The Schlieffen Plan was a famous plan for Germany to fight a two-front war against both France and Russia, and the idea was to put all the forces, or nearly all the forces in the West, and have them go through Belgium into France and trap the French army, defeat the French in 6 weeks, and then go to the East and fight the Russians in a conventional war. And that plan nearly worked, but not quite, for a couple of reasons. The going wasn't as fast on the Western Front for the Schlieffen Army as it was thought it might be. The British Expeditionary Force, the BEF, intervened and took the edge off the most powerful part of the Schlieffen Army. And finally, the Russians attacked faster than anybody thought they would in East Prussia. So all these things combined to mean that German troops had to be pulled from the Western Front to go to the Eastern Front. The Schlieffen Plan lost steam, it lost direction, the commander had a nervous breakdown. I mean, there's a lot of things that went wrong, but in any case, the Germans didn't carry it out, but they did find themselves deep into France and in possession of almost all of Belgium, and so they just built a defensive line, withdrew to it, and that line, in essence, became the Western Front. I'm oversimplifying here a little bit, but not too much. So by November 1st, 1914, there was stalemate on the Western Front. And I've got to say this, on most of the other fronts in the war, and there's going to be fronts in Northeast Germany, Western Russia, Southwest Russia, Ukraine, and Austria, there's going to be three fronts between the Austria and Italy. There's going to be a whole slew of Middle Eastern fronts in the Ottoman Empire and just outside of the bounds of Egypt, west of the Suez Canal. There's naval fighting pretty much all over the world. So anyway, that's in essence, in almost all the places where this fighting occurred, except perhaps in some sections of the Middle East, stalemate also arrived. And I'll explain a little bit more about why that happened in a moment. So stalemate on the Western Front by November 1st, and stalemate periodically in other places in the war, too. So the war's going to last from 1914 to 1918, and the United States will only enter the war in April 1917, and the first American troops will arrive on the Western Front and arrive in the war and take part in the war. The very first attack any American troop was in was last days of December 1917, earliest days of January 1918 at a place called Cantigny, as a part of a combined operation. There were just little groups of Americans training on the front until the end of May, and then American forces got in into the front for in a large scale for the first time. The American First Army made its appearance in June, and then America started fighting big battles in July and August. So only really intensively made from May to November was the United States in the war, and then of course the war ended in November. Crucial to our whole program here, our whole class, our whole investigation, is the First Russian Revolution of 1917. That was a liberal revolution, a constitutionalist revolution, you would say. And that revolution overthrew the Tsar and tried to establish some kind of constitutional regime. But in the midst of war, that just didn't work very well. And especially in the midst of a losing war, Russia had been a second revolution, and that, of course, was the Bolshevik Revolution of the next year. The photograph there is a ruined landscape with the corpses of some stretcher bearers, and I think that's particularly well-suited picture to this war, because it was a war whose nature was, in fact, really beastly. So let me talk about the nature of this war for just a couple of minutes. It was a global war. I've already discussed that. It was a war that was, frankly, unthinkable without the monetary manipulations of German tax reforms, income taxes, various central bank reforms, the Federal Reserve, set up in 1913, and all of that. Here's why. Because as many observers, many close observers of modern weaponry and the modern state predicted before the war, even from the right around 1900, the Polish thinker Jan Bloch thought that, and wrote it in his book, that the next war would be it would be so horrible. There'd be so much steel and iron and explosive force flying across the battlefield, nobody could live. I mean, everybody'd be wiped out. No country certainly could afford it. That's what other folks thought, too. They thought it would be a hugely destructive war, but that nobody could afford for it to go over a few months. And, you know, they were right. They were certainly right about that, in that undercurrent financial fiscal schemes, under in its current construction is of the state, that you really, no state could afford that. What they miscalculated was the incredibly expansive capabilities of a state that had inflation at its disposal as a tool for modern war. And so they were right in a sense, but wrong in that they didn't really comprehend the financial side of it. It was too expensive for the means of any government. What had to change to fight World War I was magnitudes of income through higher taxation, through confiscation, through inflationary appropriation and theft on the part of the government, for legalized plunder, as Bastiat would say. So that's a point that needs to be made about this this particular war over and over again. On the technological level, what had happened over time was that weapons had gotten to the point where they could shoot farther, better, and faster. And I mean artillery, the big guns, and then weapons that people carried, firearms, all around. These weapons could kill people much farther out and at a much more rapid rate. And this change in weaponry signaled at least a momentary advantage of the defensive position. Probably this had been the case as early as the Civil War and the Franco-Prussian War. And, you know, there are a number of scholars who think that, but certainly by World War I, fewer people with fewer resources can carry out a defensive than can carry out a successful offensive. That's the way it is. So what happens is this stalemate results, remember, by November 1st, 1914, and 1915 is a time when, especially on the Western Front, but on all fronts really, the armies are occupied in thinking, okay, we can fix this stalemate. We can just break through. And so they invented poison gas to do that. They invented undermining the other side and blowing them up. The artillery got more and more intense. In fact, that was the idea, to bomb the other side's trenches so much that you can get soldiers across that no man's land of the at the Western Front. But the breakthrough the attempted breakthrough leads to even greater expenditures. So there were a series of shell crises that were in the newspapers and that said, you know, we could have ended the war by in a month if we'd had enough shells to do this. The generals would say this. And so on the home fronts, everybody would get worked up and the government would carry out another war bond issue and borrow from the population. So then the shellings get longer. By 1916, even, there was, before the Battle of the Somme attack happened on the part of the British and the French, they shelled the German trenches for one whole week without really letting up anywhere on an 11-mile-wide part of the front. So, they're just, in modern terms, they were expending then millions and even billions of dollars on that shelling. And so the strains had to come home. Well, the home fronts had to be mobilized because of this. That meant they had to be encouraged to give more money. They had to be encouraged to believe that the enemy were all vicious beasts, that they were only rapists and killers and atrocity committers. And people had to be encouraged to believe that their brothers and sons and husbands and cousins had died in a sacrificial way. They had to be encouraged to believe that it was good for them to pay more taxes and good for them to eat less and all of these things. So they're mobilized, and part of this mobilization, part of the nature of the war, it both mobilizes the home fronts and then brings the civilians so much more into the war effort that more civilians are killed, both because of military planning and because of the position that the civilians have been put into. So in brief, this is a kind of nature of World War I that really is an important thing to realize. Let me read my list down here. Are we okay with the sound, everybody? And I don't think I have the chat on. Yeah, I have the chat on, but not the public. Let's see. Okay, so I'll go back to chat. Let's see. And I have a question there. I will hope somebody will remind me to get to that in the question answer. I'll say, in Ralph Raico's book, Great War Great Leaders, Ralph claims that the German decimation of the Russian army made the... I'm going to get to that. I'm on a roll here, and so I'll get to that in just a little bit when we start the question answer. So, another thing that the war did was to make the world, quite specifically, not safe for democracy. And if you want to know more about this, read my book, The Western Front. It's available new and used on Amazon, and grab a copy or read about this war. I mean, that's not the only book that covers it, but it kind of covers it in one place. So here we see, my illustration here is the Lusitania riots in Liverpool in 1915, and these people are breaking the windows and smashing a German immigrant's place of business, a butcher shop, and going to grab him and beat him half to death. So that's the way, that's part of the democratic values of this. But I guess that's a perfect democratic scene right there that we're looking at on this slide, because They're having a nice boat, and it looks like the German butcher lost, 127 people to one. But all over the place, all kinds of repressive measures came from this war. The Defense of the Realm Act in Britain on August 1914, which outlawed all sorts, criminalized all sorts of activities, including flying a kite within 300 or 400 yards of any coastline. Because you might, with your kite, be signaling German ships and subs. There's the draconian measures that Woodrow Wilson's cabinet carried out when we finally got into the war, reading everybody's mail, creation of the FBI, all of these kinds of state-enhancing measures. Same thing would go if you studied in France, and especially after the French Mutiny of 1917, the internal situation became extremely draconian, and the measures carried out by Clemenceau and his cabinet in France were extremely draconian. Germany more even than anybody else, the military dictatorship from the end of 1916 that you read about in that Hindenburg program article. Everywhere propaganda that makes beasts out of the enemy. Everywhere they're interning enemy aliens, that is innocent people who just happen to have been in the country working but don't have, don't have some kind of permanent residence or naturalization or something. And those people are all thrown into camps all over the place, in the United States and Canada as well, and Australia, and of course France and Britain and Germany and Russia. So we have all these kinds of repressive authoritarian measures that come from the war, and this is overall. It's not just in one or two places. For the purposes of this group, it's really important to think about what the Germans call the Kontrollwirtschaft, and that simply means the control economy, the command economy, which was characteristic for Germany. It was more systematic. Certainly all countries had extreme interventionism. All countries rationed their food. All countries set price controls. All countries intervened in every sort of way imaginable, interventionism at all levels and interference of all kinds. And all countries exercise this control Wirtschaft in one way or the other. The whole process of building the corporate welfare state, where the state in essence sponsors or helps out a particular country at a company at the expense of other companies, so that and then disadvantages the small fry so that the big companies can pick up those little companies. This happens everywhere, from over 1,000 electric companies in Germany to 2 at the end of the war, you see. So this control Wirtschaft is a part and parcel of the whole system. In Germany, the control Wirtschaft took the form of the Hindenburg program, which is, I have to say, vitally important for us, and it's something that that in my view is really sitting there as an important and crucial point in the writings of Mises, both in Omnipotent Government and many other writings, and we don't talk that much about it. So I think it's a very crucial thing to understand. In this photograph, Kaiser's marching in the middle of this little group of officers. There's Hindenburg. There's Ludendorff right there. Let me talk a bit about Ludendorff and the creation of totalitarianism, because I think he's one of the most neglected villains in the picture. Erich von Ludendorff was a member of the German General Staff. He was one of the toadies of Schlieffen in building this aggressive plan. And at the beginning of the war, he had some exploits on the Western Front. Then when the Russians broke into the East, this is in already in as early as August 1914, the Germans rushed a retired general, that's him, Powell, Paul von Hindenburg. They brought him out of retirement and rushed him to the East, and then they gave him as his assistant Erich von Ludendorff, who was a colonel on the Western Front. They promoted him to general and sent him to be the quartermaster general, or essentially the executive commander of the Eastern Front. And so these two, Ludendorff, Hindenburg, controlled on the Eastern Front. Hindenburg in the sort of magisterial capacity of decision making, and then Ludendorff as the nuts and bolts guy who made it all work. Okay, so that's step one. Step two is that those two men also created in the East, in their command system, the Oberkommando des Ostens, the or Oberost, as they called it back in those days, in the as a nickname. These two commanders presided over a huge staff that created a kind of totalitarian's dream. Suddenly, they issued to everybody in their vast region, which was a part, which had in it parts of Poland, Latvia, Lithuania, Ukraine, and some other places too, even parts of the old Czech world. So they had this vast area and policed it in a way that would make any totalitarian proud. Everybody was issued with a travel passport, couldn't travel anywhere without permission of the authorities. People couldn't buy, they couldn't sell. Every kind of thing was enforced. If people disobeyed, they were shot. They set up forced labor camps and so forth and so on. So it's a whole political decision-making process that leads to this kind of total control in the area that behind the lines of the Eastern Front. So that's where Ludendorff cuts his eye teeth. But with the failures of Germany in 1916, the failure actually to take Verdun, the whole command structure in the West is shuffled. The politicians finally give up, and the Kaiser calls for Hindenburg and Ludendorff to be brought to made head of all the German military, and they say, we won't do it unless we're also in control of the economy and of society. So these two are brought from December 1916 to, from the summer of 1916 to be basically military dictators for the rest of the war. All right? And what they do is to create the same kinds of things. It's the Hindenburg program, and I have a, let's see, now, Hindenburg program slide, I don't know where that went. But in any case, they create this Hindenburg program, which you read about in preparation for this course, which was just as good a kind of total interventionism as you could imagine. And then also then commanded on the war fronts, and eventually basically lost the war. Well, who could win against the might of all these combined countries anyway? In that respect, I guess they did a pretty good job. But in the end, they blamed the losses on Jews, liberals, socialists, and whatnot. Okay, well, here's the next important part of this, and there's that slide you saw a second ago. Here's what happens. Ludendorff sponsors, once the first Russian Revolution happens, Ludendorff sponsors Lenin's journey back to Russia in the famous sealed train in April 1917. This is because Lenin has said that if he were to get power, he'd stop the war. And so Lenin goes back to Russia with a bunch of revolutionaries and a train that's stuffed with money, and Lenin therefore has a leg up. His tiny little insignificant party has a leg up in all of the hurly burly of the first stage of the Russian Revolution of 1917. Okay, that's the first stage. So Lenin already has a connection with the German General Staff and with Ludendorff himself. Secondly, in step three, there's two parts, and that is that when the Bolsheviks took over in 1917, Then Lenin, in the Council of People, those commissars, in response to questions about, well, how will we create, a communist economy? He says, you know, we don't have to worry about this. The Germans have a thing. Ludendorff made it up. It's called the Hindenburg Plan, and we can just install that here. And so basically, the Hindenburg Program, the creation of Ludendorff, essentially, is filtered through Lenin and becomes then the founding structure of totalitarianism there. But the story keeps on going. After the war, Ludendorff took up with Hitler and very much shaped Hitler's views of the economy and of the state so this is a crucial part of the whole picture. Ludendorff joined the early Nazi Party, and when Hitler tried to take over the state government of Bavaria November 1923, Ludendorff was marching with Hitler as those Bavarian state police set up in the road, and the Nazis marched forward, arm's length, Ludendorff among them. And the guys aimed, but they didn't aim at Ludendorff. They aimed at some other people. Hitler hit the ground and rolled. I mean, he was a Western Front fighter after all, or at least a Western Front person after all. Ludendorff just walked right through those Bavarian state police and then left and went to Sweden for a while and then eventually came back to Germany, where he supported the Nazi cause, but he wasn't much of a joiner, and he joined an even wackier group toward the last part of his life. That's not important. But basically, this man steps into history and shapes so much of our brutal century and a half since then. It's just hard to it's really hard to imagine. But there's our guy, Ludendorff. Okay. Let me talk a little bit about the Russian revolutions of 1917, and then we'll jump into the question and answer session. I hope these links work. I meant to check them all out and double check them, but if they don't work, I think you can find them anyway just by the text. In other words, there's a Wikipedia expanded Bolshevik Revolution chronology, and if you go to that, you see that there. If you go to that, then you should be in good shape. Very briefly, and again, I'm trying to get you kind of packets of information here to remind you. Probably many, maybe most of you know all these things already, but just to get us on the right page, let me just point out this. I've got just 8 little beats here that we need to take into account. it's 1916. The biggest offensive of the whole war takes place, the Brusilov offensive. The Russians invade the Austrian Empire, and then the Austrians give way, and then they counterattack, and a million dead result from this huge months-long campaign, and the Russians start out right where they finish. They finish up right where they started out. It demoralizes the Russian army. There's all the internal corruption having to do with Rasputin and the royal family. Maybe not as quite as important as has been featured, but certainly important. The Tsar takes personal command of the army. And things just fall apart in the early part of in the winter months of 1917 with the shortages and so forth. And so there is a February Revolution that ousts the government and brings Prince Lvov to power with a government mainly of cadets, that's Constitutional Party folks, and some others. All right? these folks are committed to freedom of the press and freedom of speech and freedom of different kinds, personal freedoms, the usual liberal freedoms, and they do that right in the middle of the war. They're also committed, they say, to continuing the war. So they continue to fight the war, And what they do at home is to release all the repression, and that allows all of the revolutionaries to come back and create the revolution. So the Bolsheviks and others rush back. We've already seen Lenin rushing back, helped by the Germans. They all rush back to Russia. And the fairly insignificant Bolsheviks in the summer of 1917 get a good slogan, land, peace, and bread. It's vague enough, should please anybody. The summer of 1917 saw the army disintegrating on all fronts. The people's councils gain a lot of power, much more than the tiny little insignificant Bolshevik group. The government, however, moves to the left and to the left, and eventually it's mostly Menshevik and social revolutionary under Alexander Kerensky. The Bolsheviks try to seize power in the summer. They don't succeed. Eventually, they just roll the dice in October and are able to hang on by their toenails. A civil war results almost or starts almost immediately. The Reds, that is the communists, versus the whites. So there's a bit of an outline for you. And if you want to look here at the guys on the Central Committee of the Communist Party at the end of 1917, they renamed the Bolshevik Party the Communist Party, and there's a central committee of that, and then there is a governmental council of people's commissars. And one way that they're able to kind of get enough influence to be in power is that, in fact, they latch on to the Soviet movement so as to get all the people who support the Soviet movement. They say, well, yeah, heck yeah, we're part of that movement too, when in fact the Bolsheviks had never really had anything to do with that. So they take power. Well, how did they take power? One way was their repressive apparatus. They immediately created a secret state police in the form of an organization called the Cheka, which we'll talk much more about later. They immediately had Trotsky organize an army. They immediately started confiscating food from the fields of peasants so as to pay that army, and we're going to leave them there clawing their way into power in the different regions during the Russian Civil War. Okay, well, finally, we get to the German, so back to the German side of things, and this is this famous photograph that's discussed on that Lothar Machtan piece that you had, or rather, no, that's the one on Hitler in World War One. I think those are very interesting little pieces. I think those little pieces on Hitler give you a sense of what the literature has done. I think that Machtan, whatever else you think about his book, in which he is really his main point is that Hitler was a closet homosexual and sometimes not so closet, and that this explains a lot about him. He's not particularly anti-homosexual. He's just saying that this has explanatory power, as you know, as you read that introduction. But actually, here's a famous picture of Hitler. This is at the Odeonsplatz. It's in the one of the great central places in the center of Munich, where he had moved from Austria. That's Munich is in Germany, in Bavaria. And this picture, you know also that there's a short discussion of this. Maybe you caught this in the piece on Hitler in World War One, where you know that a photographer found out years later that Hitler had been in this crowd, and then found Hitler in the crowd, supposedly with a big magnifying glass, and that's that magnified, and there's Hitler, and he's kind of ecstatic, and all the crowd is waving and ecstatic, and the idea is that they're all ready for war, and they all want to go to war, and that Germany really was euphoric when the war broke out. But we also know from that brief discussion that, in fact, a film crew went by this area, and that this picture is, when you see the filming of this, you see that people kind of banded together. They're all parts of this Odeon spots where there really aren't people. In fact, there's a streetcar going through at the same time, so it's not like it's a totally crowded square. But anyway, it may be that Hitler's picture is pasted in there because he was actually in a different section of that crowd. No matter. I mean, the thing introduces us to Hitler, and it tells us something about the notoriously hard kind of task we have when we want to pin Hitler down in any way. Adolf Hitler was this, as you know from reading about him, and you probably know from reading books about him, he was from peasant stock in Lower Austria. His father was married. His father was an illegitimate child of a peasant woman, and they originally, the family was, her name was Anna Schickelgruber, and probably lucky for history, or unlucky for history, Schickelgruber was changed to the name of Anton Hiedler, who married Anna and adopted the son and changed his name. So that was Alois Hitler, Hitler's father, who was a retired non-commissioned officer in the Austrian army, and was therefore given the sinecure of a number of different low-level kind of jobs. He ran a toll booth across the River Inn at Braunau, in the little town where Hitler was born, and did some other fairly low-level tasks. The father was also an alcoholic and beat up Hitler a little bit, apparently. And so that was a part of Hitler's past. I'm sure you've read all these things. Well, Hitler goes, his father dies. He goes to Vienna with his mother. She has breast cancer. She's treated by two Jewish doctors. Rudolf Benyon thinks that this is the basis for Hitler's anti-Semitism. I don't think so. I think we know now that Hitler was, from about the age of 12 or 13, even in Linz, where they lived, he had already sort of bought into these anti-Semitic groups. And anyway, he goes to Vienna. He's living, his mother dies. He lives off his inheritance. He doesn't get a job. He sells a few picture postcards. He reads politics all the time. But he's basically an insignificant nobody until the war breaks out. It's 1925. And he joins the army. Like a lot of his people in his very regiment. And you read about these people. I mean, some were criminals who chose army over jail, and some people just didn't have a job and they joined up. I mean, people joined for all kinds of reasons. And Hitler was in that regiment that went to the front. He saw fighting on the Western Front, but he was a rarity. He went through all these years of fighting and only got promoted basically once. He won the Iron Cross first and second class, but you've got to read Lothar Machtan's book, The Hidden Hitler, in order to know his theory on why Hitler won those awards. In any case, he's gassed at the end of the war, loses his eyesight to hysteria, apparently, and then when Germany loses and the socialists take over at the beginning of the Weimar Republic, then Hitler is all energized against him. But he gets into the army. He gets out of the hospital. He's back in the army. And he is essentially hired by army intelligence in Bavaria as an agent provocateur. And he's supposed to go to a bunch of crazy right-wing parties. I mean, remember, there's right-wing and left-wing destabilization of the Weimar Republic. And he's hired to go do this job, basically. He's supposed to spy on these groups. But he finds one that he really likes, and he starts making speeches, and he finds his forte. And so he becomes a fairly early member of this party. Let's see. I want to go to here. This party, the NSDAP, that's the National Socialist German Workers' Party. I should have put I misspelled that when I put it in. Not misspelled, but that should be Nationalsozialistische Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, and then after that, Socialist, that's Workers' Party. Sorry, I made that mistake. I'll correct it and send another version in. It's this little band, you see them here, of, they're a little bit crackpotish. They're anti-Semites. They are, they're a little backward politically and intellectually. And Hitler just finds that he can run over these guys and take over the party and make it his own. So he changes the name a little bit, and I won't go into that. But he changes the name of the party to the NSDAP, makes it his own, and then he leagues together with other right-wing groups to try to take over the state of Bavaria. That's 1923, and it's in this way that he gets to be famous, because this famous beer hall putsch, this beer hall coup against the state of Bavaria fails, but he gets his day in court. And he gets linked in all kinds of press photos, just like this one, with Ludendorff and other famous people, a famous Freikorps guy, Richard von Epp, and all kinds of prominent people. I mean, all of these folks could have bought and sold Hitler many times over. And they were all kind of thrown into this trial together, and Hitler gets to be the ideologue of the right wing. And standing, as you see, very close and chummy with Ludendorff, having also imbibed his stuff. Well, Hitler was sent to prison for 11 months. The upper shows Hitler out of prison, but these are both prison pictures. He had a very, he's looking at this cell wistfully and wan at the outside world, but it's a pretty cozy house arrest type thing that he involved in. And he writes Mein Kampf while he's in there, a rambling piece of kind of personal views. And so that's the end of that. What happens in the books? And it might be that I would rather deal with this. I think I will deal with this slide next week. I'll just transfer it to the next group, and I believe that's all we've got. Yeah, I think I'll leave it there. So I've again gone a little bit long, but we have plenty of time for plenty of questions. And here's the thing: what I wanted to do today was to get both of these, the sort of fundamental founders, totalitarian parties, founded at least, and connected to the war in the sense that both of these parties are bringing to the table wartime things. In other words, and frankly, they're both bringing Ludendorff to the table after the war and the Hindenburg program and all that. So all these things are crucially important to the origins of totalitarians, and we've got Lenin and Hitler there in view, and we'll get more totalitarians coming next week. So I will conclude there and throw open the floor to questions, and I'll shift over and make sure I have the right chat line on. And let me just, while you're formulating your question, let me go back through the comments already and see if there's something I should answer. Yeah, I think that's right. Whoever, Danny points out he had some Tatar in him, and there is a little bit of Asian blood in Lenin for sure. Let's see. I don't remember what font that was, Danny, but I'll go back through with you if you want. I'll figure it out. Let's see. Oh, and there's Lee's good question about Ralph Rako. Okay, let me just start with that then, and that'll be a good kickoff question. in Ralph Rako's book, Great Wars, Great Leaders, another great book of Ralph's, for sure. I mentioned one last week. He's been pretty busy lately. And He says that the German decimation of the Russian army made the Bolshevik Revolution possible, and without it, the Bolsheviks could never have had their revolution. Well, yeah, I mean that's perfectly true. The Germans hammered the Russians, and I mean this whole Eastern Front war is what. In the same way that the Schlieffen Plan was broken up by the BEF and the French Army and the remnants of the Belgian Army and all that, and so that the overall vast plan was kind of messed up, the Russian plan was to have two armies, the Army of the Niemen and the Army of the Narev, converge on East Prussia and just wrench that whole part of Germany away from it, so that the Germans would have to, well, there are all kinds of consequences to flow from that. So that's what they did. And when the historical, you might say, contribution of Hindenburg and Ludendorff was not a small one in any sense. They came there and helped and put into effect the plan that defeated these two huge Russian armies. One of his commanders committed suicide in the wake of the battle, and the battles were so complete. The Battle of Tannenberg is the big one. The second was the Battle of the Masurian Lakes. And then the Russians kept on wasting troops against what was now a very strong German army under Hindenburg and Ludendorff. And in the Winter Battle of Masuria and a number of others in 1915, then the whole front stabilized. The Russians were unable to carry out an offensive, and frankly, they didn't carry out another major offensive of that type for another year. And then once you get that year past, they're not going up against the Germans. They go against the Austrians, who are in fact pretty well on the ball, and take this hard hammer blow of the Brusilov offensive, 1916, but then counterattack and drive them all the way back. So, yeah, I mean, it's the loss of the war. There's at least two major points during the Bolshevik Revolution when, if the army had been stronger, if the army hadn't been disaffected, if people hadn't been mutinying, deserting, that the Russian army would have just come back in and killed every last Bolshevik and everybody else that got in the way. In November, Kerensky's turned his army on St. Petersburg and tried to take it over, and the army was just stopped because there was disaffection in the army and because the Red Sailors of Kronstadt contributed and warship shifted sides and all that. So that's one point. And then again, in the next few months, there was the whole Kornilov episode, where Kornilov came and his army kind of disappeared too. So yeah, I think this is very true. The Russian army, Russia was behindwards in preparation for the war. I mean, they did very well for what they were, but Russia was still at least a generation behind the West, maybe more in technology and so forth. It was trying to fight a technological war with the leading technological powers on the earth, and that just took a lot of resources. There really were times in the war when the Russians attacked with one rifle per 12, or one rifle for 16 men, and the idea was when the guy with the rifle gets shot, just pick up that rifle, and eventually, you know, 1/16th of you will get there, and you'll all have rifles. So it's a pretty backward situation that's there. And so, yeah, I think Russia had collapsed, both from the standpoint of the military and from the standpoint of the military activities on the home front. So I agree with Ralph. I always agree with Ralph, no matter what he says. That's a joke. But I try to agree. In fact, I don't think I disagree with him on much of anything. Not because he's Ralph, but because he's right. Okay, Lee Kate, coming up with another question here. Good one. Do you think the Russians were behind supporting the Black Hand assassination of Franz Ferdinand? I do not. I've never seen any evidence that would indicate that. I think that was all the Serbians. I don't think the Russians would have been very happy had they known. I'm not sure the Russians wanted that at that moment. I think they had aggressive plans and they were really prepared to carry out a war in the future at some point. I mean, all these countries, this is one of the things, they were all ready to resort to this, what they thought would be a huge, big war, when in fact they should have been, you would hope they'd be more circumspect. But of course, these states want war, and it's good for them. And we know that from all the 9-1-1, effects, and we know that from World War One and from World War Two. These states, war is the health of the state. So, the Russians had war in mind in the future, but I don't believe they had any connection to the Black Hand assassinations. I believe this was all the Serbian military intelligence and a few related terrorist organizations, and they killed him. Franz Ferdinand was, by all accounts, a little bit obnoxious, but on the other hand, he was a pretty good guy, and he had some ideas to solve many of the nationality problems of the Austrian Empire. He was associated with some of the Austrian school economists in many ways, and a lot of connections there. He was not a bad guy. I mean, I think it was a tragedy in other ways as well that he was assassinated in Sarajevo. Lee comes back and says, weren't they in support of a grander Pan-Slavism? Well, they were, but I just don't think technically they. I just don't think that there's any evidence they were involved. So they were involved in some kind of scheme to hook up all the Slavs together. But you got to also take into account that the Serbs were the most independent part of all that Slavic world, apart from Russia. What the Russians were really thinking, their immediate goal when they were thinking Pan-Slavism, was to make sure that Bulgaria was the next thing on the agenda. In other words, if you think about the Russian map in the West, I have no way of throwing it up on the screen. But if you think about the Russian map in the West, the next thing that they had to expand into in 1914 was Bulgaria. And to bring it in as some kind of federated imperial state or something like that. And there's all kinds of indications about that. But Bulgaria is, in many ways kind of next door in terms of the Black Sea, and so that's a little bit easier. I don't think Serbia was a part of the immediate game plan. Anyway, though, there's a close relationship between the two, and I think that there's a lot of respect, and they're co-religionists. They're both Orthodox. One's Serbian and one's Russian Orthodox, but there's a very close connection. And we've seen that in our own times when the United States bombed Serbia and basically carried out a war against Serbia in the late 90s. The Russians, as they came in to occupy areas, were cheered as liberators. So there's certainly a connection there. No question about that. But I just don't think there's any evidence that they were involved in the shooting. Leslie says, Mises believed Pan-Germanism caused World War One. Rothbard, following Barnes, believed Poincaré and Izvolsky connived to bring about the war. Very good, Leslie, very good. Please comment. okay. And I'm reading the rest of it now. Okay, so we're back to war origins. Leslie brings up some details about that. So, it is true that Mises and Rothbard are are really in different parts of this. In fact, I wondered, as I was reading Omnipotent Government, I wondered if it would shock anyone who knows the revisionist literature and is more on the sort of Barnes, Beardian type interpretation of World War One, which was that Germany was the most aggressive country, that Germany had the biggest part in starting the war. Let me say, first of all, for everybody, and not just to this question, but for everybody, there are schools of thought that sort of put each of the major powers in a guilty role, and there's an enormous amount of evidence and all that. It's certainly true that Mises believed in the midst of World War II that the Nazis, whom he regarded as a kind of reincarnation of the Pan-Germanists, that there was a kind of continuity going back, and that the Pan-Germanists were always, had always been that way. There's a big school of thought that actually rose up on the German kind of left-wing historical circles in the early 1960s and 1970s around the German historian Fritz Fischer, whom I'm sure Leslie knows because she's well-versed, obviously, in this historiography. But and oddly, that historiography really speaks to Mises. I mean, there's all kinds of indications the Germans did have an aggressive plan, wanted to take over big parts of Belgium, wanted to control this and that and the other, wanted to have a Middle Europa that went all through Europe and hook it up with an imperial empire in Africa. Grandiose schemes of all kinds. So, yeah, the Germans were aggressive, and they did hand the blank check to the Austrians, and they did start the war with France just on a pretext and all that. Barnes, as Leslie said, believed that Poincaré and Izvolsky, that's the French and the Germans, connived to bring about the war. And so in this interpretation, Poincaré, the French president, was actually urging the Russians through their ambassador to stand firm, stand up, don't back down. And it really is true that without the Russian mobilization or partial mobilization that happened, see, when the assassination occurred, there's this frantic diplomacy that we call the July Crisis. And in the midst of that, then the Austrians want to give the ultimatum to the Serbs, and then they check it out with Berlin, and Berlin says, it's okay, do it. And so they give that ultimatum to the Serbs. Since the Germans are planning for the Russians not to mobilize in less than 6 weeks, when the Russians come up with this kind of fake mobilization, that's really mobilization, it's a fake partial mobilization, they say, well, we're not mobilizing, we're only partially mobilizing, and that means they're moving all their troops to the German border. So they do this, and this is an important stage of the war. As to what I would comment, I believe that there are none of these that are mutually exclusive. I mean, I think all the countries had a hand in starting the war, and not in a kind of passive way. I think there's a lot of sentiment there. And the British had a hand in it by just kind of laying back, watching things develop, without making any big, any really clear-cut statements. So the British had something to do, and the French had something to do because they encouraged the Russians. Nobody's innocent. There's a whole school of thought that the Austrians and their general, commander of the general staff, Konrad von Hutzendorf, brought the war on. So there's a lot of blame to go around. Well, but heck, the Serbians, you could blame them too. I know they were attacked and handed the ultimatum, but but they're the ones, for goodness sake, who sponsored the terrorists who killed the Archduke. I mean, so there's a lot of blame there. what's amazing is how willing, when you read those government documents, is how willing people were to sort of throw those dice. Great countries at stake, and as we know, a whole epoch in human history, the most brutal epoch in human history, is all at stake, and they're just willing to roll those dice. So I'd like to blame all of them. Second part of that question, in the days before the start of the war, Poincaré advised the Russians to stay firm rather than negotiate with the Austrians, as suggested by the British. Has Poincaré been treated too sympathetically by conventional historians? Oh, I think so. Although in the early days, I mean, if you read all this stuff from the 20s, and not just Barnes, but also Bernadotte Schmidt and all these other big books, they all take Poincaré to task, and nobody talks about that much anymore. But there's a historiography there for sure. So that's a great question, a great double question, Leslie. Thank you. And tell me if I didn't get to the point you were trying to get to, and then I'll get back to it in a second. So Laura writes, why was it thought that the Schlieffen Plan would have given Germany victory? Was it based on how previous wars were fought, what military science argued for, or something else? The Schlieffen Plan originated, just really quickly, the Schlieffen Plan originated in this period of the most aggressive kind of social Darwinism. At the same time as Germany got the Schlieffen Plan, they got an admiral named Tirpitz to head the German Navy, whose basic plan was, well, we got to go out in a blaze of glory. He'd been reading this naval history by Alfred Thayer Mahan, an American teacher at West Point, who wrote that basically the only way you become great, the country becomes great in history, is to just to smash all the opposition and gain control of the sea. And so this is, we think of Mahan, the American Mahan, as a social Darwinist historian who's writing, you know, this sort of history of conquest and the glories of conquest. Same kind of people who were forging the story of the conquest of the American Indians in this glorious chapter, and the settlers moving forth and all that stuff. So the Germans read that. They read Alfred Thayer Mahan. Tirpitz did in the Navy, and everybody else did. And recall last week I talked about the extent to which the social Darwinists also had a kind of vision of Armageddon. They thought, and the funny thing is, this is not really like Darwinian evolution at all. It's not like, I mean, because in The Origin of Species, the changes are all totally incremental and involve very, very slow processes. But what they were thinking is that you're getting these big organisms, call them Germans, call them British. You have these huge organisms, and they're going to clash, and that the winner is the Darwinian kind of winner. So there was that idea. Well, Schlieffen was less a social Darwinist than Tirpitz, but he did think in terms of big, big aggressive battles. And he thought that with the firepower Germany had, that they should use that firepower, that they should create a German army that was well-trained, that was on the go. It was the tradition of the Prussian general staff that they used railroads from the very earliest days, telegraphy. They were always looking for better ways to communicate, for radio when it came in right after the turn of the century. Deutsche Telefunken was a part and parcel of the whole setup. So Schlieffen is saying, well, there's only one way to beat two countries. What the diplomats have done is to alienate Russia and send Russia to the French. And so Schlieffen says, how to beat those two? And we can do that. We can do it because if we whip through Belgium and if we keep the French tied down in other parts of the front, then we can surround Paris and the French will just collapse. Because historically, Laura, historically the French had collapsed when Paris was surrounded. Okay? And so that was the idea. I mean, part of this is that Schlieffen was a kind of military historian too, and he thought that when you surround Paris and when you crush the French army between the holding parts of the Schlieffen plan and then the arm that comes around, that they'll just give up. Well, and it does happen in French history that the army gets surrounded, for example, 1940, and that they give up. I mean, this does happen. So from that standpoint, it's not that bad an argument that it could happen. It's just that it didn't go right. I mean, Moltke had a nervous breakdown just before the thing started. Here's a piece of that picture that's interesting as the war started. And it gives a little vignette that tells something about the Schlieffen plan. Schlieffen's already gone. Moltke's now the head of the general staff. He's the commander of the armies. They're about to attack France. And as everybody knows, the Schlieffen plan is we attack France first and beat them, and then we go beat Russia. So when Russia started partial mobilization, then the only thing Moltke, as chief of the general staff, he's the nephew of that older Moltke from the Franco-Prussian War. The only thing Moltke can think of is, well, we got to start a war with France some way, because that's the plan. Well, there really was a conversation at a schoolhouse in the city of Luxembourg, where the headquarters was, and the Kaiser came to that schoolhouse and said, okay, Herr Field Marshal, what's the plan? And he says, well, we've got to get up a war with France on a pretext, because we got to beat France first and then Russia. And the Kaiser says, well, we need another plan, because we're not at war with France. I mean, we don't have any cause to go to war with France. And Moltke says, well, no, that's the plan. We've only got the one. That's it. That's our only plan. And the Kaiser, they had this long talk, and at the end of it, the Kaiser's furious, and he says, you know, your uncle would have given me another answer. Your uncle would have figured a way out of this dilemma. But anyway, the Kaiser turned on his heel, walked out, and Moltke had the first of two or three nervous breakdowns during the campaign, the Schlieffen campaign, in August, September, October. So they were kind of hamstrung at the beginning because the commander-in-chief had a nervous breakdown. I mean, literally, he was just incognito, weeping for a big part of the battle. So I think it was based a bit on history, a bit on military science, and it was so well planned. They thought that their planning, just as it had done in the Austrian War and the Franco-Prussian War, they thought their planning and their high-tech stuff would bring them through. And it almost did. I mean, there are ways you can imagine that happening. Okay, Lee Cape says, I recently finished reading Chalmers Johnson's book, The Sorrows of Empire, and it left me quite disturbed. Do you think we have an empire, and what do you think about Chalmers Johnson's books? I really don't. I've just read little bits and pieces of those, so I am unable to comment on that. I do think we have an empire for sure, but I don't know what Chalmers Johnson says about that. Charles Haynes, so you consider that the level of nationalism and militarism at the time made World War I or something like it inevitable? No, I don't believe so. I mean, I don't think that war is ever inevitable. I mean, I think if somebody just says no, there's not going to be a war, then there won't be. But I do think, I mean, I'm not even sure what inevitability means in that case. I mean, does it mean that this was all predetermined by something else, or that this was, you know, kismet or whatever? Not that you intend that, but I mean, when we delve into the word inevitable, then that's a pretty tricky terrain. I don't think anything is inevitable. Even if I think that something is likely, and I think that what happened in this case was that it was in the state had experienced so much growth, and I think again I'll point back to Robert Higgs' Crisis and Leviathan. I think that that it wasn't just Randolph Bourne, the American intellectual, who understood that war was the health of the state. I think everybody did. And I think these states were looking towards some kind of clash. I think they had prepared for it, and I think they wanted to do it. It's like Madeleine Albright said, you have this really expensive military. Why aren't you going to use it? So that's a part of it. And so I think that war was likely to happen. I mean, if you and I had been talking, in 1913, and we said, what's going to happen next? It could be war. Yeah, it could be war. It's likely to happen. But I don't think that there's an inevitability to it, because the countries just could have said no. I mean, Serbia could have said, one point that struck me and as I was writing that Western Front book was that the United States ultimatum to Afghanistan right after 9/11 was exactly the same as the Austrian ultimatum to Serbia in 1914. It was exactly the same. And as with the Serbians, the Afghanis caved on all but one point, and that was, we want to go in there, we don't trust you to investigate the crime, therefore we want to go in there and investigate ourselves. That's what we told the Afghanis. They said, no, we can't do that, that's our sovereignty, and then we attacked. Well, exactly the same thing was what had happened in Serbia in 1914. The Austrians gave them this list of demands. The Serbians accepted all but the one that said, we, the Austrians, don't trust you, the Serbians, to investigate the crime, and so therefore we demand that we come in and investigate. The Serbians said, no, that's sovereignty, we're not going to allow it, and they turned it down, and then the Austrians attacked. So from that standpoint, there's that part of it, too. let's see. Would a war have happened sometime? Well, again, I don't know. It's counterfactual. I suppose so. I mean, I don't think it was just that assassination that did it. I mean, maybe they could have gotten over it. There are points at which countries have decided not to go to war. I mean, If you consider the extent to which the United States and the Soviet Union clashed head on in little hot war kinds of set tos immediately after World War II, then you have to say, wow, why didn't they just go to war? Why wasn't there a war there? Is it so countries can decide not to go to war even when they kind of want to be at war? A friend of mine who was in the occupation of Austria in the summer of 1945 and throughout 1946 said, yeah, we were rousted out many nights in full battle gear, hauled out to a front line against the Soviets, and they said, they're coming over, this is it. And so there were a lot of occasions when there's the Berlin Airlift. There are all these occasions when there were actual hostilities, and those countries, for whatever their reason, just chose not to go to war. So you always choose not to go to war, even if you want to. Okay, very good, Charles. Okay, I missed the first part of the lecture. From Lee, did you say that Lenin was supported by the Germans and Ludendorff? Yes, I did. And also, why did the Nazis so dislike the Bolsheviks when the National Socialists were basically communists as well, in that they wanted a totally state-controlled economy? Was it a difference of race? What was the difference between the National Socialism and Bolshevism? A very good question. I did say that that Lenin was actually sent. In a German train from. He was in Zurich, and the German General Staff arranged, and the German Foreign Office arranged to put him on a train with a bunch of revolutionaries and a bunch of money, and seal it up. They just boarded up the outside of the train and sent him from Zurich across Germany. They'd stop for food and supplies and fuel, and then move on. And they were taken up to the eastern Baltic somewhere and let loose in Russia. So yeah, that's certain. That's the famous sealed train. Why did the Nazis so dislike the Bolsheviks? Well, it certainly is a racial component. I mean, part of it is that Hitler's idea is from the 1923-24, he develops this idea of Lebensraum, and he says that Germany. He's a social Darwinist, right? The greatest of all social Darwinists, and in that sense. And he says, you know, in the same way that the Americans expanded west and had this sort of social Darwinistic expansion of the white Americans, and the same way that the British Empire explored all these places and made this big empire, Germany has to expand. In other words, in the Darwinian world, if you're not moving forward, you're moving backwards. And so Germany has to expand, and therefore, the only direction we can really expand, I mean, we can't just go and wipe out all the Frenchmen. I mean, they're there. We can't take that. Plus, you know, they don't have that many resources. So what we have to do, he said, is to go east. So the living space for Germany for the next 1,000 years will be expansion to the east. So we'll get more land, and we'll go in there and we'll revitalize the land and use German farming techniques and build roads and factories, and we will, but we'll be fighting all the way, we'll be expanding. So that's called Lebensraum, living space. And then the next part of that was that he didn't like the idea of the Russians was inimical to him. But it's also the case that it was Hitler's contention, and I was thinking of dealing with this a little bit later, but now it's just as good a time. It was Hitler's contention that all the leadership of the Bolshevik party was all Jewish. All right. Here's how that works. if you look at all those, in fact, I'll go back to this. My slide. Ah, there it is. If you look at these guys, and you can do this sometime. I mean, kids, you can do this at home if you want to. Just take this list of guys, the Central Committee of the Communist Party, and trace them all back. And what you'll find is not that they're all Jews. You'll find quite a few Jews on there, though. Or people like Lenin himself, who's had a grandfather who was Jewish. But and most of us would say, so what? I mean, does that make somebody Jewish? Well, as you know, the Nazis thought, yes, it does. So if you count it in the most liberal way and you know, use every time there's a toss-up, give it, you know, put it on the side, yes, Jewish, then what you do find, and I've done this, I mean, look them up on Wikipedia, you do find that the leadership levels of the Bolshevik Party was not... I'm not saying the majority were Jewish. I'm saying that Jews were overrepresented vis-a-vis the percentage of Jews in the population of Russia. So Jews were overrepresented in the leadership levels of the Bolshevik Party. Why would this be the case? Anybody like to answer that? You want to raise your hand? I'm kidding. You can't raise your hand. I can't see you. There's a good reason for this. The Jews were being, the persecution of the Jews that began in earnest, as we've studied today, in the 1880s, means that there's this increasing marginalization of Jews. And so when the socialist parties are founded in the 1890s, and all the other parties. I mean, what party accepts Jews? Which of these, you know, would the pan-Slavist party accept Jews? No, they're all anti-Semites, or most of them. Would the Social Revolutionary Party accept Jews? No, it's a Russianist. It's a socialism of the soil kind of a party. You see, so Jews wouldn't have any part in that. They would be explicitly... The SRs were explicitly kind of anti-Semitic. And so if you start rolling down your options for people who were Jews to be active politically, feeling marginalized, feeling more and more pressure, but wanting to be active politically, then it's going to turn out to be the socialist parties. And then, you know, then some go as Mensheviks after 1903, and some are Bolsheviks. But that's the origin. I mean, so the Jews are overrepresented in the leading ranks of the Bolshevik Party. There's a very simple sociological explanation for all that. So somebody like Hitler was perfectly satisfied to say, look at all these people in this picture. They're all Jews. And the ones that aren't, I mean, you know, Trotsky's Jewish and Zinoviev and Joffe and, you know, just look at all of them. They're all, even the ones who say they're not Jews are probably Jews. So that's where part of this comes from. And from the very beginning, the one thing that Hitler really shares with his, the one thing that strings together his weird, oddball kind of would-be school shooter but doesn't have the nerve or the panache to do it kind of attitude on Hitler's part is that he is involved with these pan-German groups, these social Darwinist groups, these anti-Semite groups, and they're all reading Gobineau, and they're all reading Houston Stuart Chamberlain, and they're all reading the leading anti-Semites in these little reading circles when he's a kid, which he joins. And then, so he becomes, along the way, he later said he never had any idea of anti-Semitism, but in fact, he really did have a lot of ideas about it. And that goes all the way through. So when he finds this little Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, the German Workers' Party, he says, okay, this is it. These guys are all anti-Semites, but we can do something more. And so they become a kind of, it's at first a kind of left-wing, national socialist, workers' party that's really anti-Semitic. It's anti-Semitic in saying, you know, here all these Jews have come in and they've taken over Vienna and they've taken over Munich and they've taken over Berlin and we're just sick of them and now they're not Germans. And so half of the party platform is all this discussion of who is a German in our terms. So that's why he didn't like the Bolsheviks. In other words, there's a lot of connection there between the two. But Hitler didn't like the Bolsheviks. Now, I'm going to argue later on that basically when push came to shove in the Second World War, when Hitler came to a diverging ways on his road, that he chose in the priority of whether he hated Bolsheviks or Jews more, it wasn't any toss up. There wasn't any question. In fact, he disliked Jews way more, because at the crossroads of 1941, 1942, if Hitler had turned his efforts to overthrowing Stalin, if he had armed all the Ukrainian regiments and all the other Russian regiments who defected to him, turned them against Stalin, if he had stopped killing the Jews, if he had mobilized the Russian peasants who had their families wiped out 10 years before in the horrific mass starvation in the Western Soviet Union, then then Stalin would have fallen. I mean, I think, I don't know. Again, it's counterfactual, but Hitler didn't even try. In other words, it's at that moment that he's really gearing the Holocaust up. It's that moment that, as opposed to, you know, choosing to overthrow communism, he chooses to overthrow world Jewry, as they like to, Judentum, as he liked to call it. So, I think that was the it. And I hope that helps lead answer that question. I mean, it's a question we can take up again. I don't think that's a certainly final answer. Before 1914, were there prominent figures, newspapers in Germany that spoke out against the dangers of war? There were a few. Most of the socialist newspapers spoke out against war. But then when the war started in Germany, everybody but the most left wing of the socialists voted for the war credits. And then the Socialist Party split, and actually split again before the end of the war, but it split in relation to the small group that voted against the war credits in August 1914 and the vast majority of nationalist socialist SPD members in Germany who voted for it. But yeah, the socialists were against it. Many of the liberal individuals, the little remnant of the classical liberals, it was a party called the German Progressive Party before the war. It was opposed to the war. There was a peace movement too. There's a couple of good books on the German peace movement that protested the war. So yeah, there were people around. Mainstream, it's hard to find them. I mean, Frankfurt Allgemeine Zeitung and all the big Berlin papers and the Munich newspaper, they all were pretty much on the side of the war. But so that it would be non-mainstream news sources that were speaking against it. That's a good question. Well, Lee, his grandfather was a non-observing Jew, if that's possible. Whatever. In other words, his grandfather was born into a Jewish religious family and became a non-observing Jew. So the SS would say, yeah, that makes him a Jew, but I don't know what that means. I mean, so I don't know any other way to answer that except that. Hitler and the leaders of the Nazi Party believed in the protocols of the Elders of Zion as truth. I think a lot of them did. Yeah, I think they did. And this was another expression of this Pan-Slavic social Darwinist anti-Semitic wave in Russia. What is really interesting here, I think, is that on the eve of World War One, I mean, knowing as we do that Germany eventually had Hitler, that there was all this anti-Semitic policy, that Austria was involved, and in the Second World War, in the killing of Jews, Austrians were overrepresented in the ranks of the killers and all that. And yet before World War One, if you were to single out two countries in all of Europe that were more anti-Semitic than others, then those would be Russia and France. So Russia, for obvious reasons, we've just talked a lot about that, and France, where, in fact, the whole Dreyfus affair, that's Dreyfus, Dreyfus affair, in 1894, 1898, 1900, the famous affair that split France into two. It really stirred things up. It was like Watergate and its division of our country times 10. It was a really serious political fiasco. And it all started when the highest ranking Jewish man in the French army, and the highest ranking Jewish person in the French army was a captain. He was a general staff officer, and somebody sold some secrets to the Germans in 1894, and he was blamed pretty much because he was a Jew. And so he was sent to Devil's Island. There was a big affair, a big scandal about this, et cetera, et cetera. But this raised the stakes on both sides. The anti-clerical people and the liberals joined in to support Dreyfus, the captain, and try to get him back from Devil's Island. And then the other side, the sort of anti Semitic, traditionalist, deeply conservative people. In other words, the stakes were raised, and so there was more anti-Semitism in France. There's a famous eyewitness account of a little school letting out. It's a famous French memoir that's got a terrific line in it, where this man says, "I remember standing in front of Saint somebody's school, a grade school in Paris, and seeing all the little kids come out, and it was right at 1905, at the height of the various crises and the height of the Dreyfus affair and the separation of church and state, all these issues, and I remember the little children running out of the gates of the school, chirping, 'Death to the Jews.'" So, I mean, if you had sort of singled out two places, it wouldn't have been the places that later were the Germany. I mean, wouldn't have been Germany and Austria. Then Lee asks, "Hitler and leaders of the Nazi Party believed..." Okay, that's the one I was answering. Yeah, so they accepted that Russian plan. Okay, well. We still have 11 on board. Does anybody have a question here? Have I missed any questions? I'll go to the Q&A part. No, no questions there. Any other questions? I am, we started a few minutes late, and I don't want to short anybody in any way. So any more questions here? We're now getting into the nitty-gritty of the origins, and so we're going to now move to the practice as we get these regimes going in the following weeks. Any other questions? Well, then let's call it an evening. Thank you for all the good discussion, and thank you for attending, and thanks for taking this course. And I guess I will say I'll see you next week. Correspond with me if you need to, and if you sent me a quiz, and I haven't sent it back yet, just send me a reminder and I will do it. I'm very, for those of you who are somehow got in late, it's easy to make these things up. Just get in contact with me and we will do it. Thank you very much. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And I will sign off. Good night.